From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. America holds more of its citizens in prison than any other country in the world. A new Pew Research Study Center says that 1 out of every 100 Americans is incarcerated. That's right, 1 out of every 100. That's the first issue we're going to tackle on our reporters' roundtable. And with us today, John Yearwood, world editor for the Miami Herald, Michael Fletcher of the Washington Post. He's a national economics writer and former White House correspondent, and Jennifer Gonerman, contributing editor to New York Magazine. Happy Leap Day, folks.
Hello, hello.
Thank you, Farai.
So, Jennifer, you do a lot of reporting on incarceration. First of all, is the rate up of incarceration because crime is up?
The relationship between the crime rate and incarceration rate isn't quite as clear or obvious as everybody might assume. But for the first time, as you mentioned, we now have an even higher incarceration rate than previously. I mean, several years back we passed the 2 million mark, and now we're up to 2.3 million, which translates to more than 1 in 100 American adults now locked up in either jail or prison.
What's the implication of this for a nation which is going through all these other changes, immigration, baby boomers aging? I mean, you know, from your perspective, what is this doing to the country?
Well, you know, numbers don't even really begin to tell the story of sort of mass incarceration in America because, you know, you lock one person up and, in fact, it's like you're locking up a whole family and sometimes like you're locking up an entire neighborhood since so many people are affected economically, emotionally, and otherwise by the absence of somebody. Now, obviously, there are some people that we want to see locked up and some locked up for quite a long time. But we've sort of gone way beyond that and locked up such a large percentage of our population that's having a real devastating effect on many communities, particularly communities of color in inner cities across the country.
John, Miami is a total cross-section of the world and of ethnicity. What are you seeing there? Miami is also known for, you know, huge crime scenes on the evening news. Whether or not that accurately reflects the city is another thing. But how are these issues playing out in Miami?
Well, Farai, you're seeing the same thing that you talked about in other parts of the country. It's happening here. In fact, even more so here in Miami. In fact, the same study that you cited talked about the fact that if you look at Florida as a whole, by 2009, that the state is going to run out of prison capacity. I mean, that's really startling information, particularly when you add that to the number of African-American male between the age of 20 and 34 who are incarcerated in this country. I think clearly there's a crisis out there that decision makers around the country need to deal with. And if there's any good news, I guess, in the study is that if you look at what's happening in Kansas and in Texas, they are making positive steps to reduce the problem.
And what do you mean by that? Give us a little more information on what you're focusing on.
Well, according to the study, they said that both Kansas and Texas have taken decisions that that have helped reduce the prison population in both states. And I think what's really important is that other leaders or governors in other states need to look at what's being done in these two states to try to emulate that in other parts of the country. What's interesting, I thought, that if you look at the governors of both Kansas and Texas, one is a Republican, the other one is a Democrat. So there can be a bipartisan solution to the problem.
Now, Michael, let's take it out to a broader level of politics, presidential politics. In 88, some folks may remember the Willie Horton ads. It's a part of the third rail of race, crime, and politics. Even if people begin to think that this is a major issue, incarceration, that needs to be addressed, is any of the presidential candidates going to touch it, or is it still a third rail?
I think it remains largely a third rail. I mean, because, you know, despite the factors that we've talked about, and you look at what incarceration rates are doing to state budgets, it's really just putting another onus on, you know, on states to fund. The bottom line remains, I think, that our incarceration policies are kind of politically popular, as you know, as odious as they may be. I mean, because just as incarceration has gone up, you know, crime has gone down. And granted, the link isn't clear. You know, it's such a chicken and egg argument, you know, because people talk about economic opportunity and things like that, sort of fueling a reduction in crime, the demographics, you know, the population of young people. But I think sort of for everyday voters, the fact that crime is reduced is kind of a paramount thing, because you think back not so many years ago, if you would have talked about the levels of murder we see now in this country and crime, while still high, they're much lower than they were years ago, and you know, and people are happy about that.
Jennifer, you wrote a book called Life on the Outside about a woman trying to get back into her life after spending years in prison. And you also talked earlier about how incarceration can affect whole families. What do you see happening, anything positive on that front in terms of dealing with reentry?
Well, there has been in the last, say, 5 years, much more attention paid to what happens once people leave prison, which I think is obviously very important. But the fact remains we spend most of our corrections budget putting people in prison and keeping them there, and very little on turning people back into citizens once they're released. And over the last couple decades, at the same time that the number of people being locked up has grown, the barriers to some kind of successful reentry out into society have also grown. So now you have all these people coming out of prison, and they're essentially wearing almost an invisible scarlet letter. You know, depending on the state and depending on the crime, they can be banned from certain jobs, from voting, from getting public housing, from getting a college loan, from certain welfare benefits. And that varies state by state, but it can have a devastating impact on a young person's future, particularly, you know, people coming out in their 20s or 30s and trying to do the right thing. You know, it's sort of like an incredible barrier they have to overcome. So even if we do manage to lower these crazy incarceration rates, there's going to be very long-term effects.
I want to touch on a couple more issues that are in the news, and I'm going to start with you on this, Michael. America has never had a president born outside of the 50 United States, but Republican presidential candidate John McCain was actually born in the Panama Canal Zone. His father was serving in the Navy. And while it was U.S. territory, some people are now saying that it's bringing up these constitutional issues. The president has to be natural born. Does this really make a difference? What about that issue?
Well, I think you know, Senator McCain's lawyers say no, but it's interesting. This is an issue that they've had legal staff research not only for this campaign, and now they've hired Ted Olson, the former Solicitor General, to look at it again, but also back in 1999 when McCain ran for president, this issue was kind of researched by, you know, by his aides. I think most people think that you know, obviously if his father's a military officer, he was, you know, ordered to be in the Canal Zone. He was on a U.S. military installation at the time of Senator McCain's birth. You know, most people think that he'll pass muster, but it is kind of an interesting legal question.
John, if this were Barack Obama, if Barack Obama had been born outside of the U.S., do you think it would be playing above the fold, as we say in the news business?
It probably would not. But, Fry, I think this is largely an issue in which we're talking about something that at the end of the day really amounts to nothing. I mean, in my situation, I was born on the Caribbean island of Trinidad. My sense, and certainly I'm no constitutional scholar, but my sense is that our founding fathers were planning on intent on keeping people like me from becoming president, not people like John McCain, who clearly, as has been demonstrated, was in the Canal Zone because that's where his father was on duty. So I think what at the end of the day we're really talking about something that is really just trying to keep the chattering class occupied as we go through this very exciting presidential campaign. But at the end of the day, it really, I don't think it's going to amount to much.
And Jennifer, the governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, was seeming to flirt with a presidential run at some point. He was born in Austria. Do you think at some point, if there's a popular candidate or potential candidate from outside the U.S. by birth, that these laws are going to change?
I don't know. It's a very hard call. I mean, I find it hard to believe that they would ever change those laws. But if they did, I suppose it would have to do with one person being incredibly popular. I don't know if Arnold Schwarzenegger is quite popular enough to make that happen, though.
John, let's talk about Kenya. The Kenyan government has reached a treaty with Raila Odinga's opposition party, and more than 1,000 people were killed in rioting in the past couple months after the disputed election. So from your perspective as a world editor, what do we need to look at in this story? What signs do we need to look for that Kenya can make this work?
Well, for us, certainly we got some good news out of Kenya. We've been following this for a month now, looking at the kind of devastation that this tribal conflict seemed to have wrought there coming out of the election. What we need to look at going forward is whether or not this agreement that the different sides came up with yesterday can actually hold, and whether there ultimately is some sense of reconciliation in Kenya. By the way, I want to mention that Kofi Annan, I think, did did a tremendous job in bringing both sides together because of the length of the negotiations. Clearly, it was not an easy thing to do. But certainly, he went into the middle of it and has come up with an agreement, which I think over the long run would be important and will show some signs of progress in Kenya. But I think it's also extremely important that the international community, the United States and others, really weigh in and hold both sides to the agreement that was signed yesterday. Because if we turn our backs on Kenya, as it seems that we did leading up to the last election, the result can be as devastating as we saw a month ago. So I think we really have to be vigilant going forward.
Michael, the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, made a trip to Kenya. Did that make a difference as well, the U.S. engagement?
I think it does, of course, as John was saying. I think if the U.S. is paying attention, I think people see it as more important, and I think it kind of sort of puts the onus on people there to sort of to work harder toward a resolution. So I think that makes a huge difference.
Jennifer, just briefly, you think this is going to work out?
I think it definitely is. It's very very promising news coming out of a region that hadn't had that in a while.
All right. Well, guys, thanks so much.
Thank you, Farai.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking to Jennifer Gonerman, contributing editor to New York Magazine, John Yearwood, world editor for the Miami Herald, and he joined me from WLRN News Studios at the Miami Herald, and Michael Fletcher, national economics writer and former White House correspondent for the Washington Post. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today we wrap up our month-long series on African Americans in film. We've talked about making music for the movies, stereotypes on the big screen, and indie documentaries. Today we look at the art of acting. Who's nurturing young African American talent? And where will the next generation of black actors come from? In a moment, we'll speak with two people from Black Nexus, an acting studio that's coached everyone from Jamie Foxx to Sean Combs and Chris Rock. But first, we have actress Wendy Raquel Robinson. You can see her on the series The Game on the CW Network. She's also the owner and co-founder of the Amazing Grace Conservatory in Los Angeles, which trains students aged 7 to 21 in voice, dance, and acting. Welcome to the show, Wendy.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, so what made you decide to start Amazing Grace?
You know, it started actually as a passion of love. You know, I graduated from Howard University and came back to Los Angeles and found it really, really difficult not only to break into the industry but to get solid representation. And I started doing what I know best. I started teaching my craft. And I came together and collaborated with my best friend and co-founder, Tracy Coley. And before we knew it, we had a following of young people in the city of Los Angeles that was amazing. So we just took it to the next level and developed our entire curriculum and started our own program.
What do you want to happen for your students? Is this really just a safe place for them to be off the streets, or are you trying to really create professional actors?
We do professional theater with children. So whether they want to pursue this as a career objective, or many of our students just want to have better communication and articulation and be able to, you know, hold an intelligent conversation, we provide that for all of them. But ultimately, we provide a platform where young people can express themselves in a non-judgmental environment. So a lot of my students are working actors. Some of them have basically cultivated their skills into becoming working actors, singers, and dancers. So no matter what it is that they want to do with their particular discipline, we try and give them the skills where they're able to compete effectively, or if they just want to, you know, be better human beings, you know, because there's so much going on with our young people. The dropout rate is 50%, and I've just seen a lot of young people turn away from an alternative lifestyle, you know, from the gangs, from the drugs, from, you know, coming from disadvantaged homes to really discovering the self-love through the art.
What did acting do for you when you were younger, and what does it do for you now?
You know, it changed my life. I started as a dancer, which is ironically, I started in dance classes when I was like 7 years old. And the arts in general, it kept me not only off the streets. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, so it kept my mind focused. It kept me passionate about something, so I wasn't easily distracted. Many of my peers, you know, unfortunately, you know, they did get distracted by other things, but I was able to stay really, really focused on my craft. And before I knew it, you know, when I'm graduating high school, I've been doing something that I loved since, you know, I was 7 years old, and it basically cultivated a dream for me. What it does for me now, especially working with the young people, it keeps my passion alive, because in this business, you know, it's so much rejection, and it's so much, I'm going to say there's a lot of negative things that happen on a day-to-day basis, but when I come to Amazing Grace Conservatory, as we refer to it as AGC, I'm always reignited and recharged, and, you know, I realize why I do what I do.
Why don't you give me an example of someone that you've worked with who's gone on to do great things?
Wow. I guess one of my greatest mentees that I'm the most excited about is a young lady named Nicole Salter. She started off as a very quiet young lady, wasn't quite ready to be on stage and wanted to assist me in a stage management position. So she assisted me on one of my productions because, you know, I write a lot, too. And she was fabulous. I got her accepted to Howard University, where she went and she graduated summa cum laude. From there, she went on. She was accepted to Tisch School of the Arts. And she went on and got her master's. And then at Tisch, she met an African sister, and they wrote a play about HIV, and they traveled all over from Africa to all over here in the United States, and they actually finished a performance at the Kirk Douglas Theater. And just to see her not only cultivate a dream, but to develop it and to nurture it and to find her own voice through the arts and do it so ambitiously, you know, that she inspires me. I feel like I'm not doing enough. You know, I've never been to Africa, you know, but to see her so excited about having a dream and having something that she can be excited about.
Okay, let's talk about you in front of the camera. You've been part of the hit series The Game, and what do you like about doing TV acting, and what else might you have coming up?
You know, I guess what I love the most about TV acting versus film and theater, theater, of course, is my first love. So actually, I just finished a play this weekend. I always try and go back to my roots, which is definitely theater. But what I love about television, I guess, and I have to be selfish, are the hours the most. It's so fast, and, you know, you really got to be at the height of your game. But at the same time, I'm able to have a life. You know, I'm able to, you know, cultivate my marriage. I'm able to have a business, you know, with Amazing Grace Conservatory and still feel like I have my life.
Anything else you got percolating, either with Amazing Grace or on your own?
Well, right now, you know, the strike really set us back. So I am back at work officially this week. We have 11 more episodes that we're shooting, and we're going to go really fast. So the new episodes will be airing in March. And then with Amazing Grace, we're working on Beauty and the Beast for our spring musical. And I just closed a play on Sunday here at the Los Angeles Theater Center. It was called Peaches, starring myself and Dorian Wilson and Buddy Lewis and some great talent in L.A. So I've been pretty busy.
Absolutely.
And, you know, right now I'm just going to concentrate all my energy on The Game and pray that we'll be back for a third season, and get ready for Beauty and the Beast.
Well, Wendy, it sounds like you're doing great things. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for the interview.
We've been speaking with actress Wendy Raquel Robinson. She portrays Tasha Mack on the hit CW series The Game and is the owner and co-founder of the Amazing Grace Conservatory. Even the biggest names in Hollywood need coaching some of the time. Brandi Norwood, Ice-T, Tatum O'Neal, and Q-Tip have all been students of acting coach Carl Ford. Carl is the founder and chairman of Black Nexus Incorporated, a production company and acting studio in New York and Los Angeles. We've also got Mariska Phillips, who's been a student at Black Nexus since 2002. She recently debuted her one-woman show, The Goddess Speaks, A Night of Revelations. Mariska, Carl, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, Carl, you founded Black Nexus more than a decade ago, and you teamed up with your mother, Susan Batson. Tell me about your working relationship.
I love you put a chuckle on that. That's very real. Well, I mean, I happen to be blessed with having an amazing, genius, powerful mother to work with. I think ultimately the lessons that we learn from each other are probably the most important things about the working relationship, about how we can communicate, how we can keep building this dream that we have, and also sharing a Black family business. We'd be the first in our families to do it. It was a powerful thing to create, and it's a struggle and a beautiful struggle to undergo with her every day.
Now, what exactly do you do? Say that, I walked in and I had a couple of small roles, but I had some potential. What was the first thing that you would do when I walked in to meet with you?
Well, I would probably sit you down and ask you what you love about acting. I think what really inspires you about the craft. I think a lot of people forget that acting is a primary art form. You know, the practice is critical to your success and you're working consistently in this business. So I would first try to get at your passion. And then I would, after getting at your passion, start really trying to determine how you can begin to utilize your instrument, which we call your mind, your body, and your spirit, and utilize your instrument in the creation of a character. So I would try to do different things to, illuminate that instrument. And then, we'd go through it. And one of the interesting things about going through it means that we'd have to take you through a process of reconnecting to yourself. And then I'd probably see how you responded to that and, evaluate you based on what I saw.
Mariska, when you walked into Black Nexus, what were you looking for and what did you get?
My artist was so hungry for something. I had been doing work. I did The Cosby Show. I did A Different World for the last two seasons. But I knew that there was something missing. And when I walked in there, I wanted better work. I wanted to really send my emotional life, really. I felt like I had so much to give, I just didn't know how to get to it.
So what did that mean on a practical level? I mean, did you drill on scripts? For most of us who aren't actors, I don't really know what you would have done concretely.
Well, this is the thing that I've learned. All of these events that have taken place in my life, Black Nexus showed me how to access these events. So what I bring to the work is actually the emotional life that I have endured over my lifetime. So it's these emotional sense memories that feed me the most as an artist, to really connect to the emotional life and the sensations that these past events gave me and lift it into a character so that, as Susan says, it's not acting.
We spoke with Wendy Raquel Robinson earlier. She's got an acting workshop in Los Angeles for kids. And Carl, I understand you're going to branch out and coach kids. Isn't there some line about dogs and children never starring with them? What about coaching them?
Well, it's interesting. Marion Cantone, who's currently coaching a lot of the kids who work with us privately, it's really interesting. They are so available. They're so accessible. They have so few inhibitors to their emotional life, to their sensibility, and their imagination. So they can really jump to places that adults who really haven't consistently accessed that element of themselves have difficulty with. So sometimes you get kids who are recalcitrant and undisciplined, but it really is amazing to see how they take to Susan's process, because it really feeds them. It really does, and they can jump very quickly to a character, to their bodies, to the feelings that they have, and they can send it without question. And that I love seeing. I love watching.
Mariska, your mom actually has done film, recording, Broadway. Did she ever tell you this is not a business that you have any business being in, or did she encourage you? How as a child did you process this whole dream?
Yeah, she told me that. I was interested in law for a while because I was actually really good at it. But I was a backstage baby. You know, I was raised on the road. She snatched me out of school in fifth grade and hired a tutor. And so this is all I know. It's really all I know. And the passion for it would not go away no matter what else I tried to say. Well, this, you know, I need to have a practical career, you know. But it just would not go away. And it's just where I am. Yeah, but she did try to discourage me.
It's interesting. My mother tried to discourage me, too. You know, because ultimately, they're just so nervous about the competition.
The rejection.
And the rejection and the pain. And, you know, I tell a lot of mothers who ask me, how can I get my kid out of this? And I go, you know what? Ultimately, the bug, that passion inside, that fire, it never goes away. Never, never, never.
Just this morning, I was telling Carl I had this audition, and the casting director was just an evil man. And I was like, ew! You know, and, you know, he got me all lumpy in the throat, and then I had to do another take. But I was like, you know what? I'm a professional. I can take a note. But I was just like, this is brutal. I'd never encountered such a thing.
Mariska, when you think about doing roles for other people versus doing a one-woman show, do you find that you have enough enticement that people are offering you roles that are good enough, or do you have to do your own thing?
I'm coming to that place now. The show that I'm doing now, a casting director just saw it, and he asked me to come in and be seen to play Ethel Waters. They're doing a new musical about Ethel Waters. So I'm getting the kind of work that I've been training for, you know, and my breakthrough role is right there. I'm ready, you know.
Now, when you look at things, Carl, your mom has been thanked on stage by Nicole Kidman when she won an Oscar, Tom Cruise when he won a Golden Globe. What's been the best moment for you, the kind of feedback that you've gotten from one of your clients?
I think, interestingly enough, it was Jill Scott this summer, working with her on the number one ladies detective agency. And she said something very interesting. She said, "You are my acting therapist." And thank God you came, you know. And it was interesting. She was going through so much before rehearsal and before she got to Africa. And she handled it with such grace and such poise and such understanding. And then when we got there, it's just a miracle to see her transform and to witness her. And for her to say that, thank God I came, was one of the most beautiful things I think any client's ever told me.
Well, Carl, Mariska, thank you so much for sharing with us.
God bless. Thank you.
God bless.
Carl Ford is a director, producer, and acting coach. He owns and runs the Black Nexus Acting Studios in New York and Los Angeles. And Mariska Phillips is an actress and student at Black Nexus. They both join me from our New York studios. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. When the big switch comes, will you be ready? A year from now, your old-school analog TV set, you know, the kind with the rabbit ear antennas, will be obsolete. Congress is requiring all TV stations to transmit only in digital by February 2009. Some community advocates think that Black families will get hit disproportionately hard by the switch. One group working on the issue is the National Black Church Initiative, based in Washington, D.C. Reverend Anthony Evans is president of the initiative, and welcome to News and Notes.
It's good to be here.
So it's called the Digital Television Transition and Public Safety Act of 2005. Now, it's a big bite. It goes into effect a year from now, basically. So what does that mean?
Well, it means that we got to get busy. Given the activity of the political season, we don't have a lot of time to persuade our constituents to begin to call the 888-DTV 2009 number to get their converter box so that they don't go dark come February 2009.
Explain what the converter box is and why calling this number will make a difference.
Well, the converter box, what it does, it takes the analog signature and switch it to a digital signature so that you can receive the picture like you regularly receive the picture today. Because come 2009, if you have an analog set, which is which means that is not digital, you will not be able to receive picture or sound.
So is the government just giving these away?
Well, the government is not. Yeah, it's giving coupons, and then you're going to your local electronics store, like Best Buy and a lot of other retailers around the country, and trade those coupons in. They're worth about $40, and they should be. And you, I think you add a couple more bucks to it, and they should be able to get you that converter box.
Now, why as a pastor, and you have your own church as well as being part of the initiative, why do you think this is important as a message to come from the church community?
It's critically important. Not only does the church community use a lot of technology to get our message out to our parishioners, but of course, it is critically important that an organization such as ours, who fight disparity, to advocate that we demand access to the latest technology and to make sure that the digital divide doesn't continue to broaden.
Now, when you think about your congregation, what kinds of people need to really be aware of this? What kinds of people rely on television the most, for example?
Well, those who spend a lot of time indoors, of course, and that's your elderly, and that's your those who have disability, and minorities who have little resources to get out and fly around the country. But those are the three groups that we are concerned with across the country. We plan to provide education. We plan to provide literature. We plan to work with local radio stations, local television stations, and especially the National Broadcasters Association members so that we can educate and persuade those to begin the process of calling the 1-888 number or going to the website www.dtv2009.gov to begin to secure the coupon so you can get the converter box.
We'll be sure and put that information up online as well. And
thank you.
You know, when you reach out to these big service providers, television providers, are they offering you any help in trying to reach people like your constituents?
Well, everything is a struggle, but we are in negotiation of the potential relationship with the National Broadcasters Association and also with the Department of Commerce to persuade them to offer substantive resources to an organization such as ours so that we can reach those who are harder to reach than the regular public. And we have proposed a proposal. It's being considered, and we hope that it will be accepted so that we can move forward and make this happen. We want to avoid our constituents, whether you're poor, black, white, Latino, disabled, to be in the dark come 2009, simply because this country is moving forward into a digital revolution as well as a broadband revolution as well.
Well, Reverend, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Reverend Anthony Evans is president of the National Black Church Initiative, and he joined me from our NPR studios in Washington, D.C.
There's nobody stopping you, baby. There's just yourself.
He drummed with Jimi Hendrix's band of gypsies and was the voice of the California Raisins. We're talking about Buddy Miles, who passed away this week. At 11, he started performing with his father's jazz group, the Bebops. Later, he co-founded the blues rock and soul group Electric Flag and helped pioneer the psychedelic blues rock of the 60s. His popularity peaked in the late 60s when he joined guitar great Jimi Hendrix as the drummer of Band of Gypsies. The band, considered the first black rock group, made only one album. Here's their anti-war song, Machine Gun. Miles said that Hendrix's managers fired him because they didn't want an all-black band. Hendrix went on to reunite with the Jimi Hendrix Experience, featuring two white musicians. During his career, Miles appeared on more than 70 albums and worked with greats like Stevie Wonder, David Bowie, Barry White, George Clinton, and Carlos Santana. In the late 70s and early 80s, he served a prison sentence for drug-related charges. But when he got out, he got a gig singing for the California Raisin television ad.
California Raisins from the California vineyards.
Don't you know I heard it through the grapevine?
Sounds great, doesn't it?
The ads were so popular that they spun off a series of television specials and an album. In 2004, Miles reunited with a bandmate to record The Band of Gypsies Returns. Buddy Miles died at his Texas home on Tuesday. He was 60 years old. If your band is heavily influenced by this,
never brought me no silver, never brought me no gold, just give me all to see me, I'm gonna get it for you.
Then how in the world do you end up sounding like this?
Soul of a woman was created.
'70s British band Led Zeppelin laid the foundation for an explosive style of rock and roll called heavy metal, but the rock superstars would have been nothing without American blues. Guitarist Jimmy Page closely studied blues greats like Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson, and Leadbelly. Sometimes their influence on Zeppelin's music was subtle, and sometimes it was right in your face.
Working from seven to 11 here and I.
It's been 40 years since the members of Led Zeppelin started making rock together. Ever since the group's reunion show last fall, rumors have been swirling about an international tour. As fans chew on that, we wanted to know more about the blues music at the heart of Zeppelin's massive rock sound. Joining me now is Stephen Davis, author of Hammer of the Gods, The Led Zeppelin Saga. Welcome.
Thank you.
So first, give me some context. It's the mid-1960s in England. The Beatles are all over the place. How did these four guys who formed Led Zeppelin get exposed to the blues?
Well, Led Zeppelin is descended from one of the original London beat groups, the Yardbirds, who formed right after the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. The difference was that when American blues stars would come to London, they were backed up. They needed backing bands, and it was usually the Yardbirds who backed them up. And so Jimmy Page, Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, these great guitarists from the Yardbirds, all were sort of mentored by these geniuses from coming through from Chicago. Howling Wolf, Sonny Boy Williamson, Muddy Waters, they backed them up and made records with them. So when it was time a few years later to form Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page was in a hurry for material. They didn't have time to write a lot of new material, so they decided to appropriate, as it were, a lot of old blues songs and take credit for them. And that's pretty much the first two Led Zeppelin albums.
Let's listen to a little bit of the song, You Shook Me.
You know you shook me. You shook me all.
Why did that song end up on their first album? What made it sing for them?
Well, as I said, they needed material quick, and they decided to use a lot of blues songs with which they were very familiar because they were blues scholars. But they couldn't do them as blues songs because in 1968, the psychedelic movement was at its height, and they wanted to make a sort of an atomic blues. And that's where Led Zeppelin and these very heavy blues acts come from. They're trying to make a blues-based music for the nuclear age, as it were. And so you have this incredible reserve and very heavy four-on-the-floor drumming and it was bombs away with the blues, more or less.
Explain to me how you would describe the guitar in that cut.
Yeah, well, it's a psychedelic blues guitar. Instead of sounding like the human voice, which is what a blues guitar wants to do, it sounds instead like a siren. You have to remember that Jimi Hendrix was at the same time improvising on blues changes, and this was Led Zeppelin's competition and inspiration in many ways.
Now, a lot of times there's talk about blues being just one of many African-American inspired or generated musical idioms, and rock and roll is considered another one of those. So when you say blending blues and rock, just explain where one stops and the other begins.
Well, blues, to my way of thinking, you know, there's country blues, which sort of stops at the end of World War II. That begat rhythm and blues. And rock and roll came along and was the music of young Southern whites, but obviously deeply indebted to R&B, rhythm and blues. And, you know, you played before, you played You Shook Me. Well, that was written by Willie Dixon in Chicago and sung by J.B. Lenoir. But when it came out on the first Led Zeppelin album, I think it was credited either to Jimmy Page and Robert Plant or to Led Zeppelin. And the problem many people had with Led Zeppelin was that it took too long to credit the people who actually wrote these songs. And in Willie Dixon's case, he didn't receive any royalties on any of the many songs that Led Zeppelin copied for 20 years or so.
Let's go through a little bit more of this series of influence. One of Zeppelin's most popular songs based on the blues is called When the Levee Breaks. Let's hear the original 1929 version of the song by Kansas Joe McCoy and Memphis Minnie.
If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break.
And here is the song Zeppelinized. So how do you get from point A to point B?
Well, again, it's Bombs Away with Led Zeppelin. You have this delicate, filigreed Memphis Mini guitar lick and from 1929. And let's see, 42 years later, they unchain Led Zeppelin's drummer, John Bonham. And what happens? It's blues for the atomic age. It's a psychedelic reconfiguration of, you know, a simple Delta blues.
If it keeps on raining, levee's gonna break. If it keeps on raining, levee's gonna break. When the levee breaks, have no place to stay.
Now let's look at listen to another tune that you say is a good example. It's called Whole Lotta Love. I think a lot of folks are going to know that. So it's based on the Muddy Waters tune, You Need Love. Here's Muddy's song.
You got yawning and I got funny. Baby, you look so sweet and cunning.
And here's Led Zeppelin's translation.
You need cool air. Baby, I'm not fooling.
So tell us what about this song is blues or blues-like and what is rock.
You Need Love was originally written by Willie Dixon and sung by Muddy Waters. And Led Zeppelin takes this Muddy Waters old blues and adds some cannon fire, some explosive, just incredible singing and this repetitive riff and turns it into this very hypnotic heavy metal anthem. Probably one of the most exciting things that the band ever did. And when you looked at the credits on Led Zeppelin II, sure enough, you know, the composer's credits were Jimmy Page and Robert Plant and the other two guys in Led Zeppelin. So, again, it took Willie Dixon years and years and many lawsuits. And remember, these Led Zeppelin, at the time these records came out, were ruled the booming record industry of the 1970s as its biggest act. Millions and millions of dollars were made off these songs, and the composers saw nothing until they had to sue much, much later.
Thanks a lot, Stephen.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Stephen Davis is author of Hammer of the Gods, The Led Zeppelin Saga. An updated fourth edition of the book comes out in April, and he joined me from the studios of WGBH in Boston.